Good evening, everybody. First, I just would like to thank Sarah G, Archie Monk, and then Sarah Udiloka for this opportunity for me to discuss the Dhamma here this evening. And also, I would like to mention here how I appreciate the effort of the committee members, such as Mary and others, in arranging this talk. This evening, my discussion will be about reflection on the qualities of Buddhist way of life. I will just make one point only in the course of my discussion. The point I'm going to make is that our failure to see a burden as it is in our life leads to deterioration of quality of life. In other words, not to see a burden as it is, which is ignorance, is the key to unhappiness. Then let me discuss what do I mean a burden here. I do not think I need to explain a lot as far as burden is concerned in life, because we all have burden. May I just give you one example? You go to Orchard Road and you walk, you know, along the big shopping mall, doing window shopping. So at the end of the day, you come home. You don't particularly do anything, but you just do window shopping, and then where you're attracted by fashions, by advertisements, and you go there and you keep looking at those advertisements and those goods and those shops. Say you spend about 3 hours. On the other hand, you can compare this with walking in the park, in a park. You don't carry anything. And you know you're going there just to do some physical exercise. Perhaps you go to the botanical garden and so, you know, you do some jogging, you do some running, until you get some sweating. Yeah. I doubted earlier whether I could hear myself, so I hope this time you can hear me as well. So perhaps I should repeat the message. Today, the only point I would like to make in the course of my discussion of the Dhamma here this evening is that our failure to see burden as it is contributes to deterioration in quality of life in general. Then I will have to discuss what do I mean by quality of life here and what do I mean by a burden. my starting point is to give you an example so that you can compare. Put yourself in the position of a person I'm giving in this example. So you go to the shopping centers and say you are attracted by many advertisements and you know the latest fashions. So you move from one store to another. So walking for a few hours, two or three hours. And then compare with your own experience of walking, doing a walking exercise in a park. You know that you are doing an exercise, you don't carry anything, you don't try to achieve anything, but you are there just to do some jogging, just to do some exercise. Perhaps you go a few rounds in the botanical garden here in Singapore until you get sweating. Now, what I have observed in myself and in other people is that when you go to shopping centers, you don't carry anything, and you don't buy anything, you don't need to think anything. But you just walk around and say, enjoy yourself. Doing window shopping and looking at the latest fashions. But at the end of the day, when you come home, physically you will feel tired. You didn't carry anything from the shopping center, and perhaps you didn't have any, you know, any target that you would like to achieve during this trip to the supermarket. But when you go to the park and try to do some jogging, some walking exercise, although you sweat yourself and you come home, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really exhaust yourself. You still feel fresh despite, you know, sweating after the physical exercise. I want you to contemplate on these two examples just to see how a burden is created in our mind. A burden is created in our mind. When we are distracted, we get lost in a certain fashions, you know. This is what happens to people who do shopping, I mean the window shopping. Unlike people who have specific needs with a specific the shopping list, and you go to, you know where you're going to get your things, and you go there, you buy it, you come home. That doesn't really exhaust you. But when you go round and round, you get lost in the distraction. Maybe this is good, maybe this is more attractive, or maybe this is more beautiful. So being attracted by those things, although you don't really have to do anything, but when you come home, you will feel exhausted. Exhausted. Then how do we discover this as a burden? So I hope by the end of the discussion, I will help you to a certain extent to discover this burden. But at this moment, I would like to leave this example here, and then go to how the Buddha sees life in general. We say the quality of life. Well, to have, generally we see as the developed countries, the quality of life is better. You have better access to health care, to education, to housing, and communication, transportation. So generally we say the quality of life is good. Then in poorer countries, when in the absence of these things, generally we say the quality of life is poor. This is true. This is true. But it's not this description is not everything about the quality of life. I remember Ajahn Sumedho describing about the quality of life of the people sleeping on the street in Calcutta. He said he was walking on the street, seeing people sleeping on the street. But when he looked at their face, they didn't look miserable at all. They looked very relaxed. They didn't look tense. But you can really see that those people, they don't have a good health care, they haven't got a secure future. I don't think they have any insurance, you know? So we call that in the UK insurance policy. So I don't think they have any insurance policy at all. Because they can't even afford to have a shelter over their head. But I wouldn't recommend that kind of street sleeping life as an example of a good quality of life. But at least it makes me think when I read Ajahn Sumedho's comment that those people, at least they look, they seem to be able to get something from their lives. Instead, the people in the West, he said, they look very tense, although they all have, several insurance policies. They look very tense and very stressed. And they don't seem to enjoy their life at all, some of them, perhaps many of them. And to enjoy yourself means to go out, perhaps to a pub, and with the help of alcohol to try to forget something which is burdening your mind. So here, as far as the Buddha is concerned, the Buddha recognizes that there are essential things in life that we must have. As a monk, we need robes, we need food, we need shelter, and we need medicine. So in your case, you need clothing, which is, I'm quite sure, all the fashions are ready to provide. So clothing, food, housing, and medical care. So these are essential parts of life. And on top of that, we may say, you know, education. Education is an instrument to have all these essentials. So the Buddha is not at all opposed to accumulating wealth, accumulating money, as in order to have a good quality of life in terms of materials, in terms of materials possessions. But what the Buddha is trying to say here, in terms of life, in terms of the quality of life, is that more often than not, we fail to differentiate between want and need, what we need and what we want. What we need may be very simple, but what we want can be very complicated. You see the person next to you, you start comparing what kind of bag she's carrying, so you start thinking about your bag in the context of her bag. So when you start comparing like that, life is getting complicated. Comparing. When we compare with each other, sometimes we feel very proud because, you know, our bag happens to be better, a better quality or perhaps more expensive. But when we find somebody who has who carries a more expensive bag, we don't really feel happy. This comes from comparing. In Pali, it's called mana. Mana means comparing. When you compare with one another, you would like to show, you know, that you are better. But if you find that somebody is better or is carrying a more expensive bag, then perhaps you will conclude, what's the matter? Why should I care about her bag? You know? She's leading her own life, I'm leading my own life. So these sort of things, you know, you can see in this small and very simple incidents, as comparing, you know, a bag, your bag with somebody else's, and you can see how life can get complicated. But usually we do not see it as a burden, because everybody is doing that, and you only think that it's normal to do that, and if you don't do that, it's not normal at all. And in England, many people, you know, look at my robe and they think, why you're not wearing normal clothes? They think this is abnormal. It's rather odd. I think, I usually ask them, what do you mean by normal clothes? You know, you go by a certain definition. So we do not really see a burden in that. I'm very close to parents who had children over there in England, and during the time, you know, when their children receive their results, like O-level and A-level, I really feel, you know, the tension between families, the conflict between families, because you know, they compare the results of their children. And I know all of, when it happens that I know all of them, I know both parties, I can't help but, you know, to feel the burden of having to do that. A mother told her daughter, her daughter got a very good result of the O-level. 7 A stars, and then 2 A's and 1 B. But her friends got 9 A stars. And then when she came home with her results, her mother said, what is your result? I said, 7 A stars, 2 A, and a B. Then what Susan's, the friends, her friend's result? She has all A stars. Why don't you get all A stars? She didn't even congratulate her daughter anymore, you know. She didn't say congratulations. She said, you know, why didn't you get all A stars? Since that day, you know, the mother and the daughter hardly speak to one another. And then I was called in, you know, for help. And I declare at the beginning, I think there can be hardly anything I can do. Because the mother thinks something is wrong with the child. And the child thinks her mom is abnormal. Two years later, I was able to convince the mother. I said, what you're going to build on if you do not accept these results and try to improve on that? Can you change it? After all, her results are rather good. Rather good one. So, when you compare with people, the tension is already there, the burden is already there. My daughter must do better than anybody else's child, you know. That's the attitude. So that's not real education at all. That's not about developing a child, you know. That's not the way to do that. Of course, we would like everybody to achieve all A stars, but in the end, we have to accept, as you know, each individual's limit and capacity, and we need to appreciate them. In my case, I have never had A stars throughout my life, I must tell you. And by now, I think many people know that I'm now studying at Oxford University. But many people think that it's a prestigious to be there. It's an excellent education center. I mean, I accept that. And generally, you can group people being there as those who are very rich, so their parents can afford to send them to fee-paying schools, since they are very young, or because they are very bright, they want a scholarship to go to Oxford. But to be honest with you, I don't really belong to any of those two categories. as I'm being there simply, you know, because I'm lucky. But I can see the burden of those people who come from those backgrounds. They can't enjoy life in Oxford. So I think, I told myself, so whenever I have opportunity, I must go to Singapore and tell the people over there how quality of life should be in Buddhist terms. Everybody envies, and as the children is going to Oxford. But when you go there and you examine students studying there, they don't really enjoy being there. I can tell you, they don't really enjoy being there. You know, it looks rather stressful life, and they really look forward to the end of their Oxford career. They really look forward to that. Why? Because their attitudes towards education, towards their being there in Oxford, I think from Buddhist point of view, it's not correct. That's why they have a lot of pressure. Just to give you one example, at the Central Library, I have read, what somebody has written in the toilet, of vandalism, and he said, if you have two bullets, and you have three people, there's Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, and then an Oxford student, three people, who you're going to shoot? Two bullets, three people to shoot. It's horrible to read that. You can see what's going on in their mind. An Oxford student, Saddam Hussein, Adolf Hitler, three people. In his eyes, you know, all are horrible. I hope, you know, he didn't mean me. And somebody came, you know, and wrote the answer. I will shoot at the Oxford student just to make sure he is dead. So he doesn't mind, you know, sparing the other two. This is not an indication that the quality of life of the student at that elite university is good. It's not an indication of that sort. So the Buddha said, we need to be aware of our own emotion, if not momentarily, maybe on general basis. We need to be aware of our own thoughts, our own thinking, our own attitudes. We need awareness of that, awareness, which is the essence of mindfulness meditation or satipatthana. If we do not see that, resentment that we build up, that we acquire in the course of our encounter with somebody, we just increase and increase, multiplies, and at last it becomes a burden. But we don't see it as a burden. This is the biggest problem. Barahave Panchakhanda, the Buddha declares, you know, this kind of emotion, this kind of thought is a burden, the Buddha said. But the reason why we got stuck in the circle of unhappiness, in the circle of resentment, in the circle of agitation, irritation, unhappiness at work, at home, in the community, in the society, in the in the circle of friendship, it's because of our failure to see this burden. I repeat again this message. Why we fail to see that? Let me try to analyze this academically, quite academically. Louis Dumont is the name of a French sociologist, a very famous sociologist. He analyzes the so-called problem of routinization. What I'm saying routinization, or what he means by, what is meant by a routinization here, is that you just do things, you do not feel it, and you do not think about it, because your mom tells you to do that and you just do it, because your teacher teaches you this is the way to do it and you do it. You come here to do chanting, Itibiso Bhagava Arahang. You come here to do Namo Dasa Bhagavato Arahato. You just chant. You just do it. You do not feel it. So you lose the ability to feel it, to think about it. So what you are doing is not an action at all. It's just an imitation of what is being, you know, transmitted to you from your teacher. So here it is something being taught. You do not acquire it yourself. It becomes a routine. Perhaps you come here, you bow down to the Buddha, or people go to church, and just to be there on Sunday, but you do not feel the process of the service. You do not feel it. So if you do not feel it, you do not actually acquire anything in that. So the difference here I would like to make is that between something which is taught and between something which is acquired. You are taught to do certain things, but if you can feel it, it's just like that you have acquired for yourself. So the Buddha says, Sovakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko. Sanditiko means we need to see it ourselves. We need to feel it ourselves, we need to think about that ourselves, not just follow it. So, in order to do that, what do we need? What do we need? Is it a Dhamma class? Or is it a degree? Or is it an academic course? Or is, you know, is it a transmission of the tradition? But the Buddha said no. The Buddha said it's an observation of your own state of mind, your own emotion, your own thinking. So to be able to aware, to be able to observe your own thought, your own emotion, your own thinking, that will help you to see the Dhamma by yourself, and then you will discover, you will be able to see it, and you will be able to discover the burden. Say, people who smoke because they do not see a burden of it. No matter how hard you try to discourage them from doing so, you know, they wouldn't be able to stop. But once they are able to see that smoking is really a burden, then they will be able to stop it. Before that, it's just a matter of routinization, trying to satisfy themselves, trying to satisfy their urge. So here, the burden, what I'm trying to say is that, say, somebody is criticizing you for something, and then you feel really hurt. You feel very hurt for that criticism. You think it's unfair to be criticized in this way. You may say something back or you may not, and then you go home, you still have this in mind. But because you are thinking that somebody is doing some injustice to you, your focus is not on anger but on the person. On the person. In other words, you are personalizing the emotion, which is anger. You do not investigate the emotion is the emotion or which is anger itself. So you're carrying anger with you today, you're carrying it at home, and perhaps the next day when you think about this person you will still be angry. And if you had to go back to work, well, I'm going to see the same face. And you feel very tense, perhaps you think about quitting your job even. Anger, you can see, you know, which is the burden. Now, a burden is something we collect. We have a choice to not to pick it up, to let go. But if you choose to carry it with you, to carry anger with you to your home, till the next day, till next week, till next year, it's your responsibility. You know? The world is full of people who can criticize each other for nothing. The world is full of nonsense people. So whenever we are criticized, if we will feel hurt, if we will lose our self-control, our peace of mind, there will be no time to live our own life. You may have what I described earlier as, you know, good housing. You may be able to afford everything. As a big bank account, very nice car to drive, and you can afford holidays. It's a good medical care, you know, insurance. But that wouldn't be a guarantee for peace of mind. For peace of mind. So here, as far as Buddhism is concerned, the quality of life is rather shallow, and we're not even sure whether there is any quality at all, because there is so much unhappiness whenever we encounter with people, and our mind seems to be quite vulnerable and seems to be reacting to people all the time. So reaction to all what we see, to all what we hear, to all what we smell, what we eat, what we touch, what we think, all these reactions, they become a burden. Then, can we not get rid of this burden? Of course, we can. The Buddha said, if I may quote you just one Pali sentence, Dangkho panitang dukhang ariya sachang parinya dapang. Meaning, once a burden is realized, that burden withdraw. That burden withdraw. And yesterday, one of the devotees and one of the meditation students of mine reported to me that, you know, he has quit smoking and very easily. But he tried three times before, but he never succeeded. But this time, he didn't really have any difficulty except for the first 2 days when he had some urge, you know, coming up. Because he discovered the burden of smoking. So, what I would like to give you some thought here is that our attitudes towards materials as a possession, materials life, is very important. It's okay to have a very big account. It's okay to carry many, you know, golden color credit cards. I would be very happy with you. The Buddha would be very, very happy with you. One of the blessings the Buddha always gave to people is that, may you be wealthy, may you be healthy, may you be free from poverty. And the Buddha usually gave a very long, and advanced discourses to rich people, like Dika Nikaya, Satipatthana Sutta, and all these courses, all are delivered to the people living in a very wealthy areas in India. So if people are poor, the Buddha said, you know, you don't preach for too long. So today, if I'm talking for too long, that's because, you know, I'm following the tradition of the Buddha, trying to give a very long talk to rich people. So, having said that, acquiring wealth in itself can become a burden if we do not have the right attitudes towards that. We need to ground ourselves. We need to remind ourselves all the time what is the purpose of these these acquirements. What is the purpose of these accumulations? Once we understand our purpose, there will not be a burden accumulated at all. A burden doesn't mean that having to get up early, having to go to work, having to come home late, it doesn't mean that. The Buddha slept only over 2 hours and he worked almost around the clock. And he didn't see it a burden at all. He didn't see it as a burden. He worked really, really hard. But working hard and working many hours, more than 8 hours, so when I went to Seoul in Korea, and many people, they work 16 hours. And they complained that life is really hard for them. I said, the Buddha worked, I think, about 21, plus hours. And the Koreans are at the nearest coming to the Buddha. As far as I have witnessed. But in France, you know, the unions, they have negotiated to reduce working hours. 55 hours per week or how many hours. And many other civilized countries are trying to follow them. But they really feel that, you know, people are depressed, they have no time to enjoy their life. But I do not think the Buddha didn't enjoy his life. He enjoyed it to the full. He enjoyed it very much. The reason is that he did not react to anyone who abused him. There are people who accuse him, you are really a beggar, you should work yourself and you should feed yourself. Why you come and ask me, you know, for food? The Buddha even faced these kind of people, but that really didn't affect him. He said, that's your problem, that's not my problem. So the Buddha refused to be affected by that. You see, reacting to what people say all the time is a burden. So I usually say, we need to be able to look at our mind screen as if we are watching a television, as an audience. When you watch a television, you do not react to what you see on the screen. An actor may start crying, but you don't cry. Okay? Somebody may start shouting at somebody else, but you don't do that. Somebody then may start threatening with suicide, you don't do that. You just observe. So if you are able to watch whatever comes up on your mind screen, emotion, thoughts, reaction, whatever, trying to see them just pictures, just scenes on television screen, and trying to keep some distance, observe them, at last that will lead to some sort of realization that having to do that, having to watch that, is a burden. And then perhaps you don't need to watch that anymore, and you can live without television. Very often, children in the UK, in England, children from schools, they will visit our monastery for their religious education, and often I will have to speak about Buddhism to them. And children often ask me, don't you feel bored? I said, thank you very much for your question. They really feel bored if they have to live like me. An African lady, she has joined my meditation session and she has learned how to live, you know, with less, I mean, not altogether absent, with less television, watching television less, and she doesn't really go out doing, you know, window shopping anymore. And now her three daughters are starting, you know, to question her. Why don't you have a life? They think, you know, their mother is not having her life anymore. For them, without excitement, there is no life. As children, they don't see that excitement is a burden. And they need to stimulate themselves all the time. You know, they watch telly, they feel a bit bored, they go to the fridge, open it, they eat something, they come back, they watch telly, then they go to do some, play some computer game and television again, then then go to the fridge again. At the end of the day, once everything is gone in the fridge, her children complain, this house has nothing to eat. This house has nothing to eat. Because, you know, all the foods, all the fruits, all the drinks they see in the fridge, they all look very common. It's what they see on a daily basis. It's not exciting anymore. This routinization is a problem. it becomes too common. They do not feel the significance of the fruit anymore. In other words, they do not see the beauty of what they have, what is being provided by their parents anymore. So you can see, I mean, as a parent, when you watch your children, you can see the burden of excitement, needing an excitement, needing stimulants that the child is carrying with him or with her. You may buy your child the best clothes, you send him to the best school, you buy the latest computer game, you take him to all the, you know, so Harry Potter movies, including the Lords of the what is it? The Lords of the Ring? Yes. As I'm very bad remembering these names. I know, you know, they were made in Oxford. And so the people, you know, who wrote them, some of them were connected to Oxford. But I don't really need them. So sometimes I forget their names. So you can see, you can watch, you can observe in your child the quality of life, what you're trying to provide and what they think that they are getting. Actually, they think they are not getting anything. I think I should stop here and you know, start the question and answer session. If you have questions, I would be very pleased, you know, to have them and then trying to answer. So any question? You can pass on the mic. It's not very clear. I think if I understand your question, how we should deal with distraction. Distraction actually arises through eyes, through ears, through nose, through tongue, through body, and through thought. You know, you see advertisements on the television, or perhaps your friend told you that, look, there's a new fashion. You know? Then that's information, just information. You get information perhaps through television, through the media, through your friends. The information is processed to the mind. There is a process of absorbing that information. That information creates some thoughts, what we say, an urge to go and do some winter shopping, an urge to try to acquire those things. So here, receiving information and the rise of thoughts connected to that information. So you hear that, look now, Marks and Spencer has come up with a new fashion. If your friends show you that, perhaps you go to work thinking, I must have a look. Certainly, you know, one day you will be walking in Marks and Spencer's. Now this process, it looks very simple. But when you try to observe this from meditative point of view, you can see first receiving information, which is seeing or hearing. Which is seeing or hearing. These are the two channels we receive most our information, through seeing or through hearing. Then we form our opinions, we form our want, and that want or prompts us or makes us go to Marks and Spencer's. If you don't go, that you feel something is missing. You really feel that. So, as a practitioner, what the Buddha is advising us to do is that when we see, just to simply acknowledge seeing. When we hear, just to simply acknowledge hearing. And when there is an urge to go to Marks and Spencer to acquire the latest fashion, you simply recognize that this is a desire. This is a desire to acquire. This is a want. But simply acknowledging, simply registering those thoughts, those emotional reactions, because the desire to go to Marks and Spencer is a reaction to what you see or to what you hear. So you are now reacting. What the Buddha is simply telling us is so simple. So simple. The Buddha said, register the thought. The thought that wants to go to Marks and Spencer. People in Bangkok, they want to come to Singapore for shopping. People in Singapore want to go to Bangkok for shopping. So, when a thought, you know, of going to Bangkok for shopping arises, you should acknowledge that. You should register that thought. See how where it will lead you to. Whether it will lead you to Bangkok or whether it will lead you to a meditation center. I hope it will lead you to this this hole again, and it will bring me here again. Does it answer your question? So mindfulness is the very word, which is general mindfulness. You don't need to sit down in front of the Buddha, closing your eyes. You don't need to do that if you can't. If you can, that's fine. If you can't, you just register what is on the screen of your mind. This is the desire to get the latest fashion. This is the mind which is comparing my bag with somebody else's. And there are sometimes people say, look, Arsero is in Oxford. And if you compare with other people, you put some burden on you as well. Any question? Yes. Due to the echo, I will repeat your question just to make sure that I understand your question properly. You accept that we need to be screening our mind when we see some fashion, some other things, which is distractive. But when we see some innocent pictures, yes, yes, sacred object, yes. Yeah, I think I make 2 points here. I make 2 points. when we are a practitioner, we always value, we always appreciate the image of the Buddha. And rightly so. And there's nothing wrong with that. What the Buddha is trying to teach us is that when we see, like holy objects, for example, like the statues of the Buddha, we still need to be aware of seeing, so that we know whether our mind, what our mind is thinking about. Perhaps I should put it this way. You can be just a hypothesis. You can be sitting in front of the Buddha with your eyes fixing on the Buddha, but with your mind somewhere else. Just to make sure that your mind is where your eye is. Sometimes we do chanting. I mean, as a monk, we do a lot of chanting for ourselves as well as for the devotees. When there is lack of mindfulness, we only realize the end of the chanting, because chanting has become a routine. In other words, we do not feel the chanting in the process. We only feel when it stops, because people say sadhu, just to give you an experience. And so, to be able to control our mind, when we see holy object, even holy object, innocent object, we should know that we are seeing. It's not to prevent it. It's not to stop it. If you want to go on, you can always go on. The good thing about mindfulness, about awareness, about meditative mind is that you can stop thinking when you want, and you can go on thinking when you want. These are very important points. For many people, they know how to think, but they wouldn't know how to stop thinking. In many cases, say if a person is angry, that anger will create a lot of thoughts, a lot of negative thoughts, resentment, but the person wouldn't know how to stop that anger, unless he or she is trained in meditation. So meditation or mindfulness is actually helping us not only to think properly, but also to stop our thinking when we need to. Now, by looking at the statue of the Buddha, the statue of the Buddha is here to serve us, to remind us of his teaching. So when we see the statue of the Buddha, our mind should be directed to the Dhamma that the Buddha discovered, that the Buddha practiced, that the Buddha taught. And if we are aware that we are looking at the Buddha, that will bring some sense of respect. We will behave in front of the Buddha, we will behave ourselves. I'm not saying that there are people arguing in front of the Buddha. You know, so there are good things in being aware of what is good. Actually, the Buddha said, to be aware of good and bad, when you're aware of bad things, you have the opportunity to stop it. If that bad thing is in you, if that akusala is in you, if you're aware of bad things in other people, then you will make sure that you don't have it. You don't have that akusala. If you are aware of good things, kusala, in you, then that will give you an opportunity to increase it, to make an effort to increase it. When you see the picture of the Buddha, the statue of the Buddha, if you become happy, if you become settled in your mind, then that will remind you the value of seeing the Buddha, and perhaps you will continue to do that even more. Uppannanang kusalanang binyobhavaya, to increase the merit which we are already doing. To do that, the Buddha said, we need mindfulness. So mindfulness is the basis to get rid of, the basis, or is the foundation upon which we can build more and more good things. And also, mindfulness is something, it's some instrument through which we can get rid of something bad, such as distraction. I think this answer, I don't know, some of your questions. I can't catch the last word. How to moderation? Okay. Yeah. Well, I think moderation cannot be forced on somebody. To be very, frank with you. If you want to go to Bangkok to do shopping, I can't stop you. I can't stop you. And the person has to learn through that. You all know, one of the most famous singers, the British singers, Elton John. Elton John. He has 6 cars. He spent about, if I remember correctly, about 200,000 pounds for flowers each year. And he earns millions in a year. But about a year or two ago, he has to borrow from the bank, I think about a few millions, to borrow from that. And he does a lot of shopping, all the latest fashions. And he doesn't even have time to wear them, so later he auctions them for charity. It would be very hard for me to go and talk about moderation to Elton John. I'm sure, I will be fighting a losing battle. The good thing is, though, when he sees that his effort to make himself happy, to satisfy himself through acquiring more and more wealth, more and more fashions, more and more clothes, more and more cars, and the burden of having to maintain 6 cars and a few houses, and having to host many parties just to show that you are still Elton John. So once he comes to see this burden, then moderation will come quite naturally. So the question to ask all of us is that, is it really worth going for this? When you're about to go for something, to do some shopping, do I really need it? The word need is very important. But people, children, they don't say, "Mom, I want this." They wouldn't say, "Mom, I need this." So when it says, "I want this," then there is no end to it. There can be no moderation in want. There's no moderation. Because want in itself is an extreme. But need in itself, naturally, is a moderation. So the question to ask ourselves is that, do I need, by basic question, well, this is a very big question, and first of all, I would like to say that I really wish that Einstein's prediction comes true, that Buddhism is really at the 21st century religion. But history has proved that Buddhism has always been a minority religion. I'm saying about a true Buddhist or a true Buddhist religion. I'm not talking about ritual. I'm not talking about being a Buddhist just for the namesake, just to maintain the name tag. Well, in terms of the terrorism, I think I must tell you one experience. Exactly a week after the September 11, I was invited, actually I was invited before that, but a week exactly after the September 11, I was invited by a British computer company near the Liverpool Street Station in central London. They asked me to lead a discussion about Buddhism. They don't have any shrine hall. It's in their board meeting hall with a round table. And the people from all over the world who are working for the company. I led the discussion of Buddhism because the owner of the company, he became interested in Buddhism, and then he started once a month discussion of Buddhism, and he would invite Buddhist scholars and monks and practitioners to come and lead the discussion, and they would have certain texts as a basis on which they base their discussion. What I would like to tell you is that after the discussion, at about 9:30 in the evening, I left the company, and I was on my way back to the Vihara, the monastery. I was sitting on the train, the underground, there are two youths approaching me. Are you Bin Laden's supporter? I said, no. Are you from Afghanistan? No. Do you support him? They just would like to make sure they ask me again. No, I have nothing to do with him. I'm a Buddhist monk. So you don't know Bin Laden? Well, I know him, you know, since last week, I heard. I know him since last week, just the way you do. I'm aware of the problem of the terrorism, and on the other hand, the extreme response to this real problem. I'm not sure if I can offer any answer, any straightforward answer to this. What I would like to tell you is that we need to believe in goodness when everybody else abandons it. Einstein had a very hard time to prove his theory. He has proved it, but he had a very hard time to make people accept it. But now he's a scientific god. It doesn't matter how many scientists come after him and trying to prove him wrong. You know, regardless of those developments, Einstein remains the greatest scientist. What is striking me about Einstein is his self-belief in goodness, in righteousness. And he thinks that people will get rid of superstition once they are educated, once they receive education. So Buddhism really emphasizes education. Education, you know, for children, for adults, for parents, even for the Sangha. Even if you are an Arahant, you still have to come to a fourth meeting where the Sangha meet, just to increase your education, to update yourself. So the Buddha really sees education as the main tools to solve problems. I think extremism is not accepted in a liberal society, in educated society. You know. So if Buddhism chooses to believe in itself and doing it, it can do best, like in education, educating the people the benefit of living in harmony, living at peace, and the burden of suffering, the burden of hatred, the burden of anger. Perhaps it will come to an end. No one really predicted the end of Cold War with all the nuclear arsenals, you know, in the former Soviet hands and in America and her allies. Nevertheless, when people realized, when Gorbachev realized that it's really a burden for his countries and for the people at large, the end came quite abruptly, you know. No one really predicted that, not even the Americans. So I remain positive. I think goodness cannot be defeated. You may be able to defeat good people once or maybe twice, but not forever. the history proves, history of countries, history of regions, you know, has proved that at last goodness prevails. You look at here in Southeast Asia, you look at in Africa, in Latin America, you know. Those days, when slavery system was, there was no hope for slaves, but no more slaves this day. So history has proved that things can be better. And key to that is education. So the word Dhamma includes education. What the Buddha is trying to do is that to help us to educate ourselves. And the process of educating ourselves goes until Nirvana. Thank you. I'm sorry, after the Burmese session, there will be no Chinese talk. Very good. The first thing is to use a technique. A technique is the first thing to counter routinized mind. Our mind, you know, is behaving in a very routine way. If you see something, it reacts. If something good or is wonderful, it will react like that. If something, you know, you don't like, then it reacts with some sort of opinion, oh, this is nasty. So reaction to what we like and to what we don't like is a routine. It's a routine. To counter the nice mind, we need to use something with similar effect. That's to use a meditation technique. A very simple technique. I mean, I believe there are many. And I give you one here, and from Mahasi Seattle, is to use naming technique or labeling. When the mind starts thinking, and you label it, this is thinking. It's a technique. You may not need it all the time, but you know, it works first. So they said, this is thinking. When you say that, then what is that? You become conscious of your thinking process. You become conscious of your thought. And I believe the mind will stop thinking for a short while. Just for a short while. And you have to keep doing that many times. Many times. And then as you go on doing that, as you go on labeling your thoughts, later you will realize very soon that there is a thought, that the mind starts thinking already. You will start, you will realize very quickly. Then from that point, you will be able to watch a thought. Just to watch it, like I explained to you earlier, watching television with some distance. Or this is thinking, just to watch it. It's thinking about perhaps about shopping, perhaps about your work, perhaps about somebody, who is very good to you, or who is very bad to you, or whatever, what you have to do. So whatever the thought is about, it doesn't matter. You will be able to watch that. As you watch it, you will discover a lead. A lead means that thought will lead you to something, to the cause of those thoughts. Without causes, no thoughts. There are causes of thoughts. That's why thoughts are there. So once you discover those causes, the causes of thoughts, then that thought will stop. Just to give you one example, if you're thinking about somebody, say you think somebody is really nasty to you today, so you come home, perhaps you often see his face. Perhaps you will dream about him. How nasty, you know, how dare he did this to me, you know. And the next day, perhaps you still think about him. Not intentionally, but unintentionally. Because the mind has acquired a routine of reacting to something. Something we like and something we don't like. So, once you discover that, dislike to that particular person, and thoughts regarding that person, thoughts about that person will cease. Dislike is like a driving force behind those thoughts. And without addressing the root of those thoughts, we try to stop those thoughts. It's a losing battle. So cause and effect, we're trying to go to the root. So be patient, and then just recognize maybe once or twice, this is thinking, this is thinking. Do not say, I'm thinking about him, about her. Do not say him, do not say her, do not say I, just thinking. I would like to do as a short chanting to bless all of you for your long life, happiness, good health, and all the success in your daily life, and may you all increase the quality of life. Abhivadana sila sanityam vada bhajayino jadaru dhamma vatanti ayuvanno sukham balam.